From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we listen to some great song lyrics with Robert Kimball and Robert Gottlieb, the editors of the new book Reading Lyrics, which collects 1,000 of the greatest lyrics from shows, movies, and pre-rock pop. Also, we remember jazz bass player Milt Hinton. He died yesterday at the age of 90. During his 70-year career, Hinton was one of the most in-demand bass players. He recorded with Armstrong, Cab Calloway, Billie Holiday, Sinatra, and Aretha Franklin, to name a few. He was also a photographer and published 2 books of photos of jazz musicians. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President-elect Bush has nominated 4 people to top jobs in his administration. They include Alcoa Chairman Paul O'Neill, chosen as Treasury Secretary. Bush says O'Neill has the capacity and experience to lead at a time when the economy is slowing. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
65-year-old Paul O'Neill has longtime ties to the worlds of business and government. He was the deputy director of the Office of Management and Budget under President Ford and later went on to head International Paper before going to Alcoa. As Treasury Secretary, O'Neill will have to help sell Bush's tax-cutting plans to a skeptical Congress. He will preside over the agency at a time when the economy is slowing, consumer confidence is down, and the NASDAQ Composite Index has lost half its value. Bush said he believed his nominee had the authority and experience to help calm the financial markets when necessary. With this appointment, Bush is getting his economic team in place. He has also named campaign chairman Don Evans as his commerce secretary. Jim Zeroli, NPR News, New York.
Bush also named Mel Martinez as his choice for Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Martinez, a Cuban refugee, was co-chair of Bush's reelection campaign in Florida. The president-elect picked Ann Veneman for Agriculture Secretary. Veneman was a deputy secretary in the previous Bush administration and head of California's Agriculture Department until last year. Western governors met today in Denver to confront soaring electricity prices. They called for steps to ease energy shortages in the coming months. Energy Secretary Bill Richardson added another week to his order, forcing Western power producers to supply electricity to California. Mark Roberts reports from Denver.
According to the governors of Oregon and Washington, high prices charged to utilities in California for electricity threaten to drastically hurt their state economies. In the summer, the Northwest provides power to California, and in the winter, the Golden State returns that electric power. But Washington Governor Gary Locke says tight supplies of electricity in California are now causing higher prices for consumers in the Northwest.
Customers, so homeowners, individuals, and businesses are paying hundreds of millions of dollars more than they otherwise should. That can ruin the economic prosperity that we've taken so many years to build up.
Locke and other Western governors called on Californians to conserve electricity in order to stabilize prices and pledged to come up with ways to increase regional energy supplies. For NPR News, I'm Mark Roberts in Denver.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 265 points, or 2.5%. It closed at 10,319. For the year so far, the Dow is down more than 10%. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 179 points, or 7%. It closed at 2,333. This is NPR News. The Agriculture Department has announced national standards for labeling organically grown foods. The new USDA organic label will replace a variety of 9 non-standard state rules. NASA officials say they're willing to consider new proposals for an unmanned mission to Pluto. Earlier this year, the space agency canceled a planned mission to Pluto because it was running over budget. NPR's Joe Palca has more.
NASA officials had allocated $650 million to cover both a mission to Pluto and one to Europa, one of Jupiter's moons. But when cost overruns in both missions began occurring, NASA officials decided one of them had to go. Killing the Pluto mission prompted an outcry from astronomers, who argued that studying the planet furthest from the sun may provide important information about the earliest origins of the solar system. So now NASA has said it might consider a less expensive Pluto mission, providing the scientific community can come up with one that can be launched in time to arrive at Pluto by 2015. Scientists have until March 19th to submit their proposals, and NASA will decide by fall whether any of the plans is worth pursuing. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Germany's health minister warned people today to stop eating certain kinds of sausage and other beef products because of the danger of mad cow disease. The warning was limited to products containing meat from the backbones of cattle slaughtered before the 1st of October. The health minister said the government is trying to eliminate every real risk after the disease was found in 3 cows in Germany. Mad cow disease has been linked to the human form of the infection, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. More than 80 people have died from the disease in Britain. Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Like the beep, beep, beat of the tom-tom when the jungle shadows fall. Like the tick, tick, tock of a stately clock as it stands against the wall. Like the drip, drip, drip of the raindrops when the summer shower is through. So a voice within me keeps repeating you, 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 night and day. You are the one, only you, beneath the moon and under the sun. Whether near to me or far, it's no matter, darling, where you are, I think of night and day.
That's Fred Astaire singing one of the 1,000 great song lyrics collected in the new book, Reading Lyrics. It focuses on song lyrics from shows, movies, and pre-rock pop. My guests are the editors of Reading Lyrics, Robert Kimball and Robert Gottlieb. Kimball is a music theater expert who has also edited collections of the complete lyrics of Cole Porter, Ira Gershwin, and Lorenz Hart. Gottlieb is the former editor-in-chief of the Knopf Publishing Company and the former editor of The New Yorker magazine. Here's a song which Kimball and Gottlieb agree has one of the greatest lyrics. It was written in 1937 by lyricist Ira Gershwin with music by his brother George. This features Mel Torme.
It's very clear, our love is here to stay. Not for a year, but ever and a day. The radio and the telephone and the movies that we know may be passing fancies, and in time may go. Our love is here to stay. Together we're going a long, long way. In time the Rockies may crumble, Gibraltar may tumble, they're only made of clay, but our love is here to stay.
Robert Kimball, Robert Gottlieb, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
The song that we just heard, the Gershwins' Our Love is Here to Stay, where does that fit in, Robert Kimball, in your world of lyrics?
The last song George Gershwin wrote, and maybe one of the greatest last songs written by any composer. And Ira finished the song after George died. George had only written the refrain.
And Robert Gottlieb, in terms of the writing and the rhymes, what do you find really special about that song?
Well, you know, one of the things that's said about Ira Gershwin is that his rhyming is very complicated and maybe over-clever. And here in this song is the proof that that was not necessarily or often so. Just go right to the beginning of the refrain in that it's very clear, our love is here to stay. The way that in the middle of the line that catches, and again, and in time may go, but oh my dear, and you hear that echo, but it's not a bang rhyme at the end of a line. It's just in there. And then it's all so simple. And then you get that wonderful image at the end of the Rockies and Gibraltar, which is the only fancy moment, and then it's gone. I just think it's a perfect lyric.
Now, I can't imagine where you started in trying to examine all the great lyrics of popular song from the turn of the century to 1975. How did you go about, first of all, surveying what they were and then figuring out which were worth including?
Well, I don't know how other anthologists work, but I work, and we worked, by diving in the middle without a plan. I happen to have a vast record library, and I just started picking up records and listening to hundreds, thousands of records, and supplementing that by looking at printed books, sheet music, etc. And I would gather together hundreds of songs that I thought were possible, and Bob would come over, and we'd sit and listen to them all, and we'd start drawing up lists.
Right.
And then it turned out to be by lyricist, because we weren't even sure it was going to be done that way when we started work on the book. It ended up a book about lyricists as much as a book about songs.
And I brought tons of songbooks over to his house. He probably wondered if he'd ever be free of them as we've cluttered his living room and worked together very, very well back and forth. But we've worked together for years.
Now, I know that choosing pop songs is not an empirical process where you could actually measure what is the better song. So did you have criteria other than what really struck you for inclusion in the book?
One criteria certainly is that songs that have endured. I mean, songs have a way of living, and how they live is a fascinating process. Sometimes they burn brightly in a way, and then they somehow pass from view for a time and come back. So there are many different avenues you have to explore to make this all come together. So I think that the fact that we were open and that we knew we were going to go through a very long process of learning, listening, thinking, reflecting, shaping was all part of it.
But finally, I think we felt that those songs that we were going to include were songs that could be sung today by cabaret singers or whoever. In other words, that they had a viable life in the now. They weren't just historical curiosities. And that applies to some of the very earliest songs, which maybe at this moment no one is singing, but they are songs we thought could be sung now and wouldn't be risible.
Let's play a song that I think works really well on a lot of levels. It's one of the songs that you both brought with you today. The song is These Foolish Things. And I think this is an example of a lyric that just works as good writing, but also it has really pleasing rhymes. Bob Gottlieb, would you talk about this song a little bit, why you chose it?
Well, it's always been one of my favorite songs, so that's a good reason to have chosen it. What we're going to hear today, Ella Fitzgerald singing it in a concert version, and by the way, people say that Ella scants words. You can hear here that, again, that is not true. She is right on top of the words and their meaning. You have no feeling that she's sacrificing them to the jazzy aspects of
it. But the voice is so beautiful that that's what people are responding to. The sheer beauty and glory of the voice is so great that we often forget that she's fine on words.
This is also one of the not many examples of a first-rate British song, because this was written in England. By three people, of whom the key one for the lyric is a man named Eric Maschwitz, although when it was published, he didn't use that name. He used the name, Marvel?
Holt Marvel?
He used the name Holt Marvel.
I think he used other names, too.
He had a prodigious career in England. He wrote operetta, he wrote musicals, he wrote reviews, he wrote books. He's a very interesting person. But this song has prevailed, and it's sung by everybody.
When you point out in your book, you wrote the screenplay for Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, why don't we hear These Foolish Things sung in concert by Ella Fitzgerald.
A cigarette that bears a lipstick traces and airline ticket to romantic places, and still my heart has wings. These foolish things remind me of you. A tinkling piano in the next apartment, those stumbling words that told you what my heart meant. A fairground's painted swings. These foolish things remind me of you. Telephone that rings, but who's to answer? Oh, how the ghost of you clings. These foolish things remind me of you. You can.
That's Ella Fitzgerald in concert singing These Foolish Things. And one of the many lyrics included in the new book, Reading Lyrics, which is edited by Robert Gottlieb, former editor-in-chief of Knopf, and Robert Kimball, who's an expert on music theater and has edited several books on lyrics and composers. Do we all like the rhyme of the piano in the next apartment that told me what my heart meant?
I like it.
Yeah.
It's so unexpected. And this song leads to all those other songs like Thanks for the Memory, that also are nostalgic about
they're list songs where there's like a list of things that you're thankful for or that remind you of something.
Right.
And I think that list form is a whole genre of song. Robert Gottlieb, you've edited, published many books of poetry.
For sure.
I mean, you're the former editor-in-chief at Knopf.
Yeah.
And your publishing company put out many, many books of poetry.
And still does.
It still does, and I'm sure you've read much poetry over the years. How do you think of lyrics as compared? How do you judge lyrics differently than you judge poetry?
Well, it's very, very complicated, because a lyric is half of a work of art, or half of a non-work of art, depending on what the song is. And you can read it and speak it separately, and yet you know that something is not there that is intrinsic to it, whereas a poem obviously stands by itself. And you are very affected when you read a lyric by whether you know the tune or not. It's a completely different reading experience. And that's why it's so hard to judge these things, because there are certain songs we all know that we were born knowing them. And how do you forget the music to Night and Day? You can't. You can't read Night and Day, You Are the One, without hearing Cole Porter.
My guests are Robert Kimball and Robert Gottlieb, editors of the new book Reading Lyrics. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guests Robert Kimball and Robert Gottlieb edited the new book Reading Lyrics, a collection of 1,000 great lyrics written between 1900 and 1975. I think that a lot of people used to read rhyming poetry.
Yeah.
And very few people read rhyming poetry or write rhyming poetry anymore. But I think song lyrics have given us our fix of rhymes, that we get our rhymes through songs or through rap, depending on what it is that you listen to. Do you agree with that?
I think that those of us who grew up with the classic songs, which mm-hmm. is most of the century, definitely are affected by rhyme that way and hear rhyme because of that. Whereas, as you say, in the 19th century, people who grew up on Longfellow, Paul Revere has rhymes, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but it is songs, I think, that give us our sense of rhyme. And that's why our ears spasm when we hear bad rhymes or fake rhymes. It's just wrong. We still get rhymes in country music. You know, it's one of the reasons I think country music is still so successful.
I think there's certain expectations that you bring to a kind of classic American popular song. One is that there'll be a verse. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of setup before the real melody begins. And the other is that there'll be a bridge, that after you hear the real melody sung through a couple of times, there's going to maybe be a key change, there's going to be a melodic change, you're going to go into a different direction, and then you're going to have the pleasure of returning to the familiar direction that the song initially brought you mm-hmm. in. Is that like a 20th century phenomenon, that type of pattern for a song?
I can't speak about way, way back and in art songs to what extent they followed these very somewhat restricted patterns.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's been fairly common in the songs, although you do have in theater songs some variation in that. You have extended numbers where the number is really a series of sections that don't follow that prescription, very often an opening chorus or a number that might lead out of a big scene. This is much more related to the kind of operetta-style song that was a big part of the European tradition that, of course, got incorporated into our American polyglot tradition in the 20s.
Yeah, in a lot of musical plays or musical comedies, you will find a song in which there's, let's say, a witty patter or a witty refrain, and then there'll be another, like, introduction to it, and then there'll be another. In other words, the chorus will come back and back and back after extended sections that are different.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about some of the there's a few African-American composers from the earlier part of the century that you include in the book, each of whom have written at least one song that most people will know, though few people will recognize their names. And I'm thinking of Harry Creamer, Cecil Mack, Shelton Brooks.
Sure. Shelton Brooks, of course, is known for a number of songs, but Some of These Days is considered one of the most important songs of the century by many.
And I think most of these lyricists got started in vaudeville acts, which is interesting. And I thought another interesting thing is that most of them, although they were African American, wrote for a lot of white performers as well as black performers. That the color line didn't stop them or stop them completely, anyways, from placing songs with famous white singers like Sophie Tucker.
Sophie was very special, and they all loved writing for her. And she was wonderfully supportive of the Afro American songwriters. They all loved her very much.
I thought maybe we could hear from one of the lyricists singing the song himself. And this is Shelton Brooks singing Some of These Days. And it was Sophie Tucker who had the big hit of this. But this is a recording he made at a 1940 concert in San Francisco as a benefit for ASCAP. And I think you can hear in his singing that he really is from vaudeville. So why don't we hear the lyricist Shelton Brooks singing his own song?
Some of these days, gonna make me honey. Some of these days, you're gonna feel lonely. You gonna miss my hugging. You miss me kissing. You miss me, baby. When your daddy goes away, you feel kind of lonely. Hold me only. You know how. let you have your way. When you leave me, I know it's going to grieve me. You're going to miss your bald head, Daddy. Some of these days. Yeah, let's sing.
What do you think about Robert Kimball, Robert Gottlieb, listening to that?
Hearing the stride piano accompaniment.
And that's the lyricist at the piano,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, you know, it's... you're right, he's a vaudeville person who had to get over. All his songwriting teams were vaudevillians, and they all performed their own material. And it was very important for them because they didn't get really great spots on the vaudeville bills across the country in those years. And they had to work their way up so that occasionally when they got to next to closing, that was pretty extraordinary. But yes, they were their own promoters of their songs, and this is a great song. What a neat performance.
Robert Kimball and Robert Gottlieb edited the new book, Reading Lyrics. They'll be back in the second half of the show. Let's close this half hour with a great lyric by Tom Adair. The song is Everything Happens to Me, and the singer is the song's composer, Matt Dennis. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I make a day fog off, and you can bet your life it rains. Try to give a party, and the guy upstairs complains. Guess I'll go through life just catching colds and missing trains. Everything happens to me. I never miss a thing. I've had the measles and the mumps. And every time I play an ace, my partner always trumps. Guess I'm just a fool who never looks before he jumps. Everything happens to me. At first my heart thought you would break this jinx for me, that love would turn the trick to end despair. But now I just can't fool this head that thinks for me. I've mortgaged all my castles in the air. I've telegraphed and phoned, sent an airmail special to. Your answer was goodbye, and there was even postage due.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA. Providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from the Dial Press, publisher of Letters of the Century, edited by Lisa Grunwald and Stephen Adler, a collection of over 400 letters from famous figures and ordinary citizens chronicling our country's history. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're listening to Cab Calloway's band with Milt Hinton on bass. Coming up, we remember Hinton. He died yesterday at the age of 90. Also, more song lyrics.
What do you know, Gate? Are you in the know or are you a solid bringer down? Listen here, Jack. Take it slow and you can learn just what I mean. Are you hep to the jive? Are you hep to the jive? Are you hep, are you hep, are you keeping it step? Are you hep to the jive? Do you lace your boots high? Are you fly or you fly? Do you dig, do you dig, do you swing on a gig? Are you hep to the jive? Do you get in the groove? Does the beat make you move? Do you send yourself jacking and then trillion back again? Know that it's smooth. Oh, are you hep to the jive? Are you hep to the jive? Are you hep, are you hep, are you keeping it step? Are you hep to the jive?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Kimball and Robert Gottlieb, the editors of the new book, Reading Lyrics. The book collects 1,000 of the greatest lyrics from shows, movies, and pre-rock pop, and features short biographies of the lyricists. Robert Kimball also edited collections of the complete lyrics of Ira Gershwin, Lorenz Hart, and Cole Porter. He's the artistic advisor to the Ira Gershwin and Cole Porter estates. Robert Gottlieb is the former editor-in-chief of the Knopf Publishing Company and former editor of the New Yorker magazine. I'm interested in the music that you grew up with. What was the music that you first became aware of and that first got you interested in music? Robert Gottlieb?
The first song I remember focusing on, for what will be obvious reasons, is coming home from summer camp one year. I must have been 9 or 10. And the kids in my class were singing something called Mersey Dotes. And Ozzy Dotes and Little Lambsy Divey. Not in our book, actually. And then I thought, what is this? And I felt very left out and behind because I had been away and I didn't know what this was. And so I started listening to the radio. And then this was a period of songs like Blues in the Night came and Chattanooga Choo Choo. And those were songs that were my first real Point Siena, Your Branches Speak to Me of Love. These are the songs that were real to me when I was 10, 11.
I remember Sentimental Journey.
That's later.
Yes, this is a few years later. And that would have been the mid-40s. That was pretty early for me. But my experience is because my mother both played and sang was the theater. And early show experience, of course, was Annie Get Your Gun and hearing Ethel Merman perform. That was very exciting for me. And I came to know her later in life and remained a big admirer of hers all the way to the end.
Did either of you have, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and there was this huge musical gap between what I was listening to as a child and what my parents were listening to. They wanted to listen to the station that played Perry Como. I wanted to listen to the station that played Elvis Presley. And there was a real musical war going on. Was there a musical conflict when you were coming of age with your parents?
No, it was quite
the
opposite.
Not at all. There was the same music that I felt. That was your experience, too, Bob?
Yeah. For instance, my mother played the piano, and she loved to sing, and we used to sing a lot. We sang a lot of Gilbert and Sullivan. She'd play, and I'd sing. But when Oklahoma opened in the early 40s, which is the first musical I really remember seeing, we bought all the sheet music, and we sang all those songs from Oklahoma. And that was the way people really were related to music then. As it's now become almost a cliché to say it. There was a piano in every middle-class home, and people played and sang together. And that's how we knew those songs. Yes, there was stuff on the air, but it was nothing like the way it is today.
So instead of having a garage band, you sat around the piano in the living room.
That's right. And even if you had a garage band, your mother wasn't going to be part of it, I believe, in your day.
Absolutely.
Unless your mother was a very special lady, right?
Yeah. Well, radio was important.
Radio
and
was important.
Your hit parade, and it was a show we listened to.
Important.
And my parents always told me that they got married to I'm in the Mood for Love, which was a 1935 song. And so I always became drawn to that material because it meant something to them. So we were still connected musically.
Are any of the songs that you brought with you today songs that you remember from your childhood?
It's the Lovely.
Yes, I would say It's Still Lovely.
Making Whoopee.
Making Whoopee certainly would be a song that I remember. It was just this huge body of sheet music that sat on the piano bench. And as I say, both my parents loved music and performed, but my mother was especially, really loved it and taught it to me. When I was learning piano lessons, I also learned little plunk out occasionally a little simplified version of a pop song or a theater song. I mean, it was a great moment in our house when the songs from Carousel came to us. My mother just thought that were the greatest things that we'd ever heard.
You mentioned Makin' Whoopee. Why don't we hear that? In fact, why don't we hear two versions of that? Because you were talking about how these songs have such a remarkable life and how they're changed depending on what era it is and who's singing it. So why don't we play the Eddie Cantor version, which you brought with you, and then hear that back-to-back with the Ray Charles version. Did Eddie Cantor have the first hit of this?
Yes, he was in the musical.
He introduced the song. It was from a show called Whoopee in 1928 by Walter Donaldson, the composer, and Gus Kahn, lyricist.
It was a Ziegfeld show. And then it became a wonderful, there was a wonderful filmed version of it also with Eddie Cantor. really the truest view we have of Ziegfeld shows comes from that movie of Whoopi. Yeah, and again, just this is a song that was written for Eddie Cantor. This is one of those situations in which songwriters wrote for a particular star and his delivery. And then you can see what it's like when somebody from a completely different background, not a vaudeville Ziegfeld background, but a much more contemporary R&B background, how he deals with it.
Let's hear it.
Another bride, another June, another sunny honeymoon, another season, another reason for making whoopee.
A lot of shoes, a lot of rice. Groom is nervous, he answers twice. It's really killing, the boy's so willing to make whoopee whoopee. Picture a little loveliness, yeah. Down where the rose is clean, picture that same sweet loveliness. See what a year can bring. I tell you, the boy's washing dishes and baby clothes. He's so ambitious, ooh, I tell you, he's so. It's really killing, the boy's so willing to make whoopee whoopee.
That's two versions of the Gus Kahn lyric, Making Whoopee. We heard Eddie Cantor, for whom the song is written, and then we heard from Ray Charles, one of the many lyrics included in the new book, Reading Lyrics. The two editors are my guest, Robert Kimball, who has edited several books of lyrics and is an expert on music theater, and Robert Gottlieb, the former editor-in-chief of Knopf, former editor of The New Yorker magazine. Well, that is one of the great don't mention sex, but it's about sex kind of lyrics.
Right.
find a nicer word to use than sex. And of course, you know, listening to that, you can't help but think, too, Pepsi for those who think young, because it's one of the many songs that eventually became an advertisement, a jingle. And I think people who love songs always feel so irritated
And yet it's a prime source of income for the estates of these writers.
Yes.
Well, I've become much more philosophical about that over the years. And I hear
Well, you handle the Ira Gershwin estate.
I do,
and
Cole Porter. And when I hear, well, we've made some mistakes. We allowed I've Got You Under My Skin to advertise a cleaning for a toilet bowl. I've Got You Under My Rim. That was one of our classic oversights. We managed to let that go by. Anything you guys want is fine with us. But I hear, yesterday I was listening to a commercial for the Harlem Globetrotters, and there was Sweet Georgia Brown. And a lot of people don't know that. It's a great song, Sweet Georgia Brown, and Maceo Pinkard. And you hear it with the Harlem Globetrotters. It's their theme song. So I suppose that, you know, The Love Nest was kept alive by Burns and Allen's radio show. So many of these songs are connected through commercials, and it's okay.
Have either of you tried your hand at writing lyrics?
Only for special occasions for friends. Sometimes somebody would want something written for an occasion. I used to write campaign lyrics for John Lindsay when I was his legislative assistant.
No.
They're pretty awful. But I was, when he was a congressman, we would go up to New York together, and John and Mary Lindsay would sit on the Eastern Shuttle and laugh reading the Sunday Times while I was penning out a version of You're the Top that somehow extolled him above every other political figure since Abraham Lincoln.
Do you remember any of the lyrics?
Let's hope not. I think I probably do. How could I forget such matchless greatness? No, they were for the occasion. Then I'd have to teach them to the campaign workers. And the Lindsays laughed a lot.
Robert Kimball, Robert Gottlieb, thank you both so much for talking with us about lyrics. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Robert Kimball and Robert Gottlieb edited the new book, Reading Lyrics, a collection of 1,000 great lyrics from shows, movies, and pre-rock pop. Coming up, we remember bass player Milt Hinton. This is Fresh Air. Bass player Milt Hinton was a beloved figure in jazz. He died yesterday at the age of 90. That's Milt Hinton with Benny Goodman, recorded in 1959. Through Hinton's 70-year career, he was one of the most in-demand bass players. Among the people he played with were Cab Calloway, Louis Armstrong, Lionel Hampton, Coleman Hawkins, Benny Carter, Frank Sinatra, and Billie Holiday. He not only made his mark in jazz history as a musician, he helped record jazz history through the thousands of photographs he took of his fellow musicians at home, on the road, and in the studio. His photos were exhibited in galleries and collected in two books. Fresh Air guest host Marty Moss Cohen spoke with Hinton in 1988 after the publication of his book Bassline, written with Dave Berger. Marty talked with Hinton about his famous photo of Billie Holiday at her final recording session in 1958, making her album Lady in Satin, which featured Hinton on bass.
Love is tearful. Oh, it's gay. It's a problem. Oh, it's play. It's a heartache. Anyway, but beautiful. And I'm thinking, if you were mine, I'd never let you. Be but beautiful, I know.
This was our last recording session, and she really was not well, and she needed the money. She hadn't been working regularly. She needed the money, and they asked her to do this recording. I guess the people knew that there wasn't much time left. And she agreed. She says, if you can get the guys that used to record me years ago, if you can find some of those fellas, I'd be glad to do it. But we were all there, and it was the music was great, and she just wasn't in a position to sing. Her voice was a little bad, and here you see her after we'd make this record, and she's listening to herself back. And, of course, no photographers were in there because you can't have photographers around when we're recording. Could have a clicking of the camera, but I can wait until the recording is over, the playback is on, see, and then I whip out my camera, and here she is listening so intently to how good the music sounds, and her singing is not what she expects of herself. And some of the shots are just really very sad, because there's one shot, I don't think David put it in the book, of her with a, she hears a bad note, and she sort of grimaces, and you can see a tear coming in a corner of her eye. And one of the pictures shows the music. I didn't even really see that when I took the picture and composing the picture. I was concentrating on her face and how she was reacting. But when I looked at it later, the music side, the music, the the title of the music was But Not For Me. So it was these kind of things that I was trying to capture.
You were born in Mississippi, in
Vicksburg,
a town?
Mississippi.
Yeah. What kind of a place was Vicksburg?
Well, for a black guy like me, it wasn't too easy. It wasn't too good. I don't remember too many bad things about it, except one lynching that I really saw once. It was very, it was exciting and frightening to me.
Well, you were about 7 or 8 years 77 old.
77 years old, yeah. I saw this. And
what did you see?
Well, my uncle had been in an automobile accident, and I had gone to the hospital to see him with my mother's youngest sister, who was just about 4 or 5 years older than I, and she was a sort of chaperoning me because I was about 7 or 8. Coming home, and we saw this mob of people, and we had to go right by this street in order to get to our house. So this great mob of people there, and they were carrying on with a lot of noise, and it was gun shooting. And being inquisitive like any little boy would be, I just walked up to it. My aunt was trying to pull me away, and there was this black man up, hung up on a tree, and they put a drum of gasoline under him, and the gasoline, the fire was burning. He was running like a piece of bacon. But the guy had long been dead because he had been accused of looking in some window or something at somebody undressing. And
what kind of impression did that leave on you?
Well, I couldn't really understand it. I couldn't believe what I'm seeing. It didn't leave me with the impression that this was a human being. It was just a body here. But the sad part, when I got home, my grandmother and all of the black ladies in the neighborhood were getting their children, the boy children, together, and they would put black pepper in the socks of the children. Wow. And the boys, so that if a dog came to smell him, the dog would go away, so they wouldn't be, in case a dog came and barked or whatever. But if they had black pepper in their socks, a dog wouldn't come near them. This is a kind of a defense that these people, and my grandmother had been a slave when she was a young girl. She had been a slave of Joe Davis, who was Jefferson Davis' father, who was president of the South. So her name was, and she took the name of, at the Emancipation Proclamation, she took the name of her overseer, the man that was over the plantation. His name was Carter. So her name was Hetty Lady Carter Robinson. And she was freed in the time as a girl, and she grew up and married a man named Matt Robinson and had almost 13 children by him. The last child born 5 months after his father was dead. Mm. So this poor lady must have had some time trying to raise these children. A great deal of the children died early in childbirth, like early in the life. Only 5 or 6 really survived, of which my mother was one.
You moved to Chicago. I guess you were maybe 10 years old, something like that.
Something like that.
It was your first train ride. And what was Chicago like? I mean, you were a kid coming from Mississippi, from the deep South, and Chicago was quite a town.
Yeah, well, it was quite a shock and quite an experience for us. My mother had preceded me. My mother and my uncles had preceded me to Chicago. They had come ahead of us to make room for, to get some places to stay and get some jobs, because everybody in the South had been hearing about Chicago being very, lots of work for unskilled blacks.
You talk about some of the people in your high school who went on to fame, and there was someone, I suppose, more infamous in Chicago that you had seen, and that was Al Capone.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was a big influence in Chicago during my early years.
He kind of ran the place, didn't he?
He sure ran the place. And he ran it on we looked at him more or less as a Robin Hood.
Did you?
We really
did.
I mean,
in spite of his reputation for violence and...
In spite of his reputation, there wasn't that much violence. It was a matter of control. Al Capone, it was violence if you didn't go by his rules. But if you went by his rule, example, if he came into a black neighborhood, he hired all black people to take care of the vices and the alcohol and the prostitution. He hired all black people in the neighborhood to take care of. Say, now you run this hotel and you buy your alcohol from me. You buy it from me at $12 a gallon, and you sell it at $8 a gallon, at $16, so you make $8 or whatever it is on a gallon. So anyway, this is a way to run around in the neighborhood. But the black people were in charge of it. And I remember...
You used to deliver, didn't you?
My uncle... After school, my uncle was in charge of this, selling this stuff to the, what we call flats. These are where the houses where people come and have a little party or something, sit around with the ladies. And we delivered alcohol to these people. They bought all that, people in the neighborhood bought it from us. And my uncle would have me go with him to deliver it. And I got a terrible accident doing that. And
almost lost your hands, right?
Yeah, almost lost my finger. And in fact, it was just almost off in this one accident that I was in. And I was screaming because I was studying violin and playing violin. And the doctor said, well, my everything on my right side was broken, a tremendous scar on my face, and my right arm was broken, my hand was broken, and the finger, my finger was just hanging off, you know. And the doctor said, of course, Earl Cohen heard about it because there was alcohol all over the street, just cans of it. My uncle was out cold. I thought he was dead. He had a lot of money in his pocket, and I picked it up and stuck it in mine. And I got to the hospital. They got me to scoop me up out of the street and get me to the hospital. And this doctor said, well, I can't do anything for this finger. I'll have to cut it off. And Al Capone had heard about this accident, and he came over to see that everything was okay. And the police never said a word about the alcohol in the street. It was just like it was water out there. And he came to the hospital to see how I was coming along. And I was in there screaming when the guy said, you got to cut my finger off. And I said, oh, please don't do that. And he said to this doctor, he says, don't cut his finger off. Don't cut it off. And I have that finger to this very day.
You have Al Capone to thank for it, right?
I sure do.
We'll hear more of this 1988 interview with Milt Hinton after a break. Hinton died yesterday at the age of 90. This is Fresh Air. Jazz bass player Milt Hinton died yesterday at the age of 90. Before we get back to the 1988 interview that Fresh Air guest host Marty Moscowain recorded with him, let's hear Hinton with Cab Calloway and his band.
Come to play bass? Because you started off with violin.
Oh, yeah. Well, most of the kids in the neighborhood when I was 13 years old, July 18th, 1923, I took my first violin lesson.
You remember the day?
Yeah, I remember the day. Very, very, very important to me. And I played the violin in the orchestra. And then 1929, Al Jolson made the first sound movie in 1929, the jazz singer. And in all the neighborhoods, there was big orchestras in every theater because they had the silent movies, so they had an orchestra. Matter, it was a small neighborhood. You'd have two or three pieces, a piano and a violin to play for the music on the screen because there was no sound there. But when he made that first movie, the jazz singer, there was sound. Every orchestra lost their job because now the sound is on the screen. It's recorded. So all of the neighborhoods, all the violin players all over the United States lost their jobs in the theaters. And especially in this black community of ours, every black violin player lost his job. So here I was just about prepared to enter this great world of theater, and there was no jobs available. My teachers that were teaching me had no jobs. And Al Capone, again, our Robin Hood, had opened up a club called the Cotton Club on the west side of Chicago in Cicero. You know, of course, the Cotton Club meant that you had black entertainment. It wasn't black customers, but the entertainment was all black, girls and boys and orchestra. And I'm prepared. I'm at the state of age where I'm not ready to go out into the world. And all of my peers from high school that played horns got a job in Al Capone's orchestra, the Cotton Club Orchestra over there. And there we were. My parents were making $25 and $30 a week in the stockyards, working the porters in the railroad stations. And here we are, the guys are making $75 a week, which was astronomical salary, and Capone made it possible for him to get anything they want. The guys would say, look, I need a car. I said, go down there and tell him I said, give you a car, and you can pay $5 a week on a car or something like that. And here I'm delivering newspapers for $9 a week because I'm still playing this violin. I know it's much music, but I don't have it. The thing, I'm playing this violin, and I'm delivering newspapers, and these guys are getting off at 5 o'clock in the morning from these nightclubs, and I'm just beginning to go out with my newspapers, and I would be so embarrassed I would hide. I wouldn't let them see me. They had Ford cars with disc wheels, and that's when I said, heck, I got to get me another instrument. So I thought it was quite easy to come from violin to bass because they're both string instruments, and they both have four strings.
And was it easy? Was that an easy transition for you?
It was the easiest.
I mean, they're four strings, but it's
well, four strings. Yeah, they're exactly backwards. The violin is E-A-D-G, and the bass is D-G-A-E. So fourths become fifths on inversions when you study harmony.
Yeah.
If you turn it around, you can count it around. It fourths becomes fifths. So that wasn't too bad of a conversion for me. I was accustomed to strings, even though this was a big one. And I thought I'd try that, and it worked out very well. I kept practicing on it until some old bass player got too drunk to make his engagement.
That's right. He said
and he said, well, just try this kid tonight. We can't do it better. And I did fairly well, and of course they were satisfied. And the next time the guy got drunk again, they called me, and until I finally got to the place where I was doing pretty good. And that was the biggest decision of my life, to decide to give up my newspaper route, which I was sure making $9 every week to take a chance on music, because I wasn't too sure it was going to make it, and I was getting $19 for this one job. But it was very sparse. It came once every two, 3 weeks or something like that.
Milt Hinton recorded in 1988 with Fresh Air guest host Marty Moss Cohen. Hinton died yesterday at the age of 90. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
You'd be so easy to love, so easy to idolize, all others above. To keep every home fire burning for, we'd be so grand at the game, so carefree together that it does seem a shame that you can't see your future with me, 'cause you'd be old, so easy to love.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air, and from Nonesuch Records, featuring Red Dirt Girl, the new album by Emmylou Harris, available in record stores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Alfred Molina. He's starring in the new film Chocolat. His other films include Boogie Nights and Prick Up Your Ears. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.